I've had the opportunity to speak at this venue once before, back probably around 1993, I guess. We were over at the Mac Center. And at that time, we were coming fresh off of creating the transport layer of the digital HDTV system for the Grand Alliance. And I was invited to come out here and give that presentation to you to give you a sense of all the wonderful flexibility and great things that the future had. And I think the notion that came out of that meeting was, this is really great stuff, so how do we do it? And so that's what we've kind of been spending jointly, I think, over the past 8 or so years trying to figure that out. And finally, I think we're getting to some of those solutions today. And so what I wanted to do was take you through some of the technical issues. And I think George's talk that preceded us was a good introduction to this. And I'm going to try to fill in some of the more technical details behind some of the issues that go on in compressed video data manipulation. Talk about some of those same type of functionalities that George spoke to and give a little bit of the background on that. And then Jerry's going to come up and we'll talk about some of the applications that are now enabled with these kinds of technologies. So, as I mentioned, we'll talk in why work in the compressed domain, what are the challenges, and review some of the past attempts, the fits and starts that we've had in going through this type of capabilities. What are the new technology enablers that allow us to get into this type of technology now? And then talk about splicing and logo insertion that George had touched on. Another interesting application of rate control, which allows you to try to squeeze additional channels into the particular applications. And then, as I mentioned, Jerry will talk about two particular applications doing digital television with a full MPEG master control suite. As well as central casting, which is a new idea that's been gaining an awful lot of acceptance. So as I look back over how television has been evolving, it's clear that we are in the middle of this transition between analog NTSC and digital television, and there's a tremendous difference that everyone is going through. Whereas NTSC there were a lot of bolt-ons that we tried to do with various things to include additional services. Absolutely, the closed captioning types of activities that have gone on and introducing the ability to address the deaf and hearing and disabled communities was a tremendous advance in being able to do that and add some additional functionality to that. But NTSC itself was rather primitive in terms of just delivering a single format, a single program, and was really only television with the exception of a few of those additional elements that PBS has really pioneered through the way. But that really set the stage for what we really needed to get to, which is digital television, which is all about service. And I think that's one of the real kinships that Sarnoff Corporation really has with PBS, and I think that extends into the Agilevision family with PBS, in that we try to make sure that we're stretching for what this technology can possibly deliver. And the notion of the delivery of service to your members is just tremendous. And also the kinship around HDTV and the highest quality that we can possibly deliver. With the digital television, however, we have multiple formats, whether they're standard definition through high definition, and we obviously have a lot of extensibility. We could be going further into that in the future. Multiple programs so that we can be simultaneously delivering these types of technologies and services to the viewers. Including the enhanced services that we can deliver. And we're clearly getting into an issue of now of delivering compressed content to people. If you look out and see where the world of TiVo is going and being able to push a lot of information down into a box and then be able to play that out, tremendous opportunities that this resides. But it still creates the challenge of how do we attack this? How do we actually implement this? And how do we deliver it in a way that makes sense from both the cost structure as well as being able to evolve the overall business models and services that you would like to experiment with as you finally get there. And where we have been focusing our effort is identifying ways of doing that with multiple functionalities collected together and being able to drive off of scalable software systems because that's clearly one of the enablers that's going on. If you look at the overall production flow, more and more of the content is being delivered through digital channels. And finally getting to an area where the changes that have been made through the distribution for the network to the local production pass-through, And I went and left my laser pointer way over there. Going from the ability where digital really first came into play of delivering network content to the local stations, but also then getting into contribution levels from remote acquisitions back into the network or local productions. Finally, with the digital HDTV standard, we get in the ability of applying those same kinds of technologies so that we can now deliver to the home through the transmission system those services in a compressed digital effort. And here's where a lot of the challenges are. You've got limited sizes of pipes going on from different places. There's an affordability in terms of how you're able to do those types of things and how much space you're taking up. And over time, we're getting better and better at how we do the compression so that we're taking up less and less of that space. But in the meantime, we still need to figure out how do I do the functionality that has to happen here when I'm delivered something that has been compressed to some level. And part of the challenges that we like to be able to provide is being able to make this as cost-efficient distribution as possible, be able to do all the functionality that you need to do in your local production and pass through, and then be able to drive it through to the transmission sites. So as you look at that, it obviously creates some additional concerns that people have. But it also provides us with some excellent opportunities. When you work in the compressed domain, you can start taking advantage of the quality that you can invest in at a single place that is going to then be distributed to multiple points. So when you have quality at a particular point, being able to keep it in that compressed domain allows you to preserve that quality as much as you possibly can without having to concatenate multiple decode and re-encode functions. Clearly, the cost savings that you're able to do in reducing the amount of transponder bandwidth or storage that you need to be able to take, if you can keep those elements in the compressed domain, still enabling the types of functionality you need to be providing, you can still significantly reduce the amount of storage you have to do and the amount of server farms and disk space that happen over time. We're clearly still in the advantage of riding a curve where storage is getting larger and larger and the cost of storage are getting lower and lower. But it's still, any time you can create those kinds of savings by staying in the compressed domain, I think you would like to take advantage of that just because it's a lot easier to keep track of all that information as well. Most importantly, and I think that's the issue that we really need to be addressing, is how to simplify the DTV transition. There are so many issues that come up. There's so much flexibility that we've built into this overall system, and at various meetings I've actually apologized for the Grand Alliance for building in so much flexibility in the system, because it's obviously clobbered how you have to implement these things. But by providing things in the compressed domain and attacking them in the compressed domain, we can in fact simplify that transition. You can do more things at a centralized location. You can provide additional choices for the individual stations to determine how they're going to mix their different functions together. And I think that's truly possible if you do this and attack it in a way that allows for true scalability and upgradability so that you can try out a particular scheme, a particular mix of services, and still have the ability to build onto that and add additional services as you go forward. Focusing on challenges and past attempts. I've been part of a very large collaborative research effort. In fact, there were actually two very, very large efforts in this space. One was the Atlantic program that involved the BBC and a number of other folks where they were trying to address how you might be able to deal with a lot of these capabilities. And here in the States, through a NIST program, we were able to pull together a number of different partners that included Tomcast, formerly at the time we were working with our friends there. It was Comark, and along with Sun Microsystems, IBM, Philips, Thomson, NBC was a partner in some of that activity as well. And we were also able to bring in New Jersey Network Public Broadcasting local to us in Trenton to give us some real-world experience as we try to implement these types of features. That effort actually is what led to the creation of AgileVision and being able to apply the types of things that we learned in how to deal with compressed domain processing and deliver that to the market in a productized version. There's also been some efforts that have gone along the way in MPEG and SMPTE, as both of those tried to deal with approaches to provide station functionality at the transport level. So at MPEG, there was the notion of being able to deal with splice point insertion and packet countdown so that you could identify when a splice opportunity was going to come up. And at the transport layer, we were trying to deal with things of saying, in this many packets as you count down, that's when you're going to be able to do a splice so that you could have somebody looking ahead for when that opportunity was going to happen. And some of those elements and some additional ideas that we developed actually in the early days of our NIST collaboration led to the SMPTE 312 standard, which had a similar type of thing of staying at the transport level, identifying an appropriate point in the transport stream to say, here's a point where you can splice from one service to the next and insert new program material at that point. And that led to the SMPTE 312, and I'll speak a little bit to that right now. SMPTE 312, I think, was a good idea at the time. Maybe it was the best idea that we had at the time. It's probably a more accurate way of being able to address it. But it clearly has some limitations, and I think has also led to the point that says, I think there's very few that are actually utilizing it today because of some of those limitations. In a core point, the SMPTE 312 required you to precondition the stream in several ways and constrain it so that it could enable splicing in the compressed domain. And so you had to precondition the stream, make sure that you were able to identify where a valid splice point was so that it was at the beginning of a GOP, set a flag in the transport packets appropriately so that you could identify that as a particular splice point. And you also had to manage the buffers of the video so that it was always, whenever those splice points came along, you had the buffers at a particular point that was agreed upon so that you wouldn't have any issues of video buffer, underflow, and overflow. And I'll get into some of those technical issues in a few minutes. But that created some issues. So while it enabled a generic functionality of being able to splice in the compressed domain, it caused other issues. First of all, to avoid having too much overhead, you had to push the splice points out so that they might come every 2 seconds or so. And a lot of the feedback that we got from the user community is that you can't give that kind of constraint to folks. They need to be able to employ this new digital technology in the same fashion that they've been doing television production systems as they've been working for years. And being able to say I can only switch once every 2 seconds was not a valid type of operation. The other thing is that because of this management of the buffering, because you always had to return to a particular spot in the buffering, the rate control systems and the encoding process at that time had a tendency of creating some problems in the picture quality. You would get when we were debugging these kinds of systems, we call it the heartbeat of America, because you would just get this pulsing in the picture. It would just look like the throbbing of a heartbeat. Depending upon the criticality that you look at the pictures with, it's either something that's somewhat visible to just completely annoying. So I think that's one of the issues that really created some of the problems for SMPTE 312. So as we looked at the splice points and the technical challenges, and in fact we brought to NAB with the with that NIST collaboration and actually the formation of what was Comark Digital Services, a demonstration of where we were at that point in time for compressed domain splicing and other capabilities. And the feedback we got back in terms of the challenges that still needed to be faced was, number one, the precision of splice points. You need to be able to keep that down to a very small number of frames so that people can do as close to frame accurate editing as they possibly can. The other is the latency between the time that you issue a splice command and it's affected in the actual stream. So if independent of where precisely it's happening, if you give a command and then it takes several seconds for it to actually respond and react to that, that can be a real issue in terms of production. Ability to monitor at the splice point and know exactly where it is that you're switching so that you can have some live interaction between individuals was also a concern that we heard back from the user community. Perhaps the biggest issue that we heard was that the lack of branding for the local signal or logo insertion was a killer for this kind of technical application. The amount of investment and the importance that stations placed on being able to have their local brand visible to the viewer, that they'd invested so much money and time creating that sense of community with the viewers, was an essential part of their signal, and they could not let the new digital television signal get out there without addressing that capability. And for many of the early adopters, they went to more expensive solutions that did not allow for working in the compressed domain because they needed that logo insertion. And George spoke to that a little bit in his presentation as well. So we took that back as feedback that we needed to go off and find a solution for that if we're going to make compressed domain splicing and other processing important to this community. And finally, buffer management needed to be robust and avoid any non-compliant streams and picture freezes when you went through a splice point. I'm going to quickly speak to some technology enablers that are really exploding right now that we think have helped us get to this point. So the time frame that I've been talking about is about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, when we initially rolled out the ideas and the algorithms. And it's taken us a few years to actually get those refined and be able to deal with some of the new processing capabilities to take advantage of that. So among those enablers are software-based products that allow for very much a larger level of software integration. We're able to deal with the rise of very powerful processors that are being used everywhere, from Apple computers to the latest IBM PCs, and riding Moore's Law, where you can count on the fact that those are going to continue to drive further and further in performance and down in cost is very important. Lowering the cost of storage, as I mentioned before, is an important point here. Another piece, though, is just the overall compression efficiencies that are required and the ability to now to do compressed stream manipulations that we've been able to pioneer. I mentioned briefly the computing platforms that we have. In particular, we've been focusing on the Motorola G4 processor with AltaVec technology because it provides really a supercomputer capability on a chip. It's very well tailored to the type of pixel processing capabilities and DCT domain processing capabilities that we need to do. We also take advantage of interconnect technologies that allow for extremely high bandwidth and scalability of processors so that we can attach multiple processors together in a seamless fashion to attack how we take multiple streams and seamlessly attach them together as well. So with these types of technologies, we're then able to provide new capabilities. I must say I had some additional slides that I was going to bring in, some files that we're going to be able to show you some of the capabilities that we've had here. Unfortunately, I tried sending them over the email. I swamped George's Ralph's computer email, and it actually got back at me and killed my laptop. So I don't know how you did that, Ralph, but it was impressive. In any event, the AgileVision 1000, just to give you a brief hardware overview, it truly is a supercomputer platform. It's built on parallel processing with distributed architecture so that we can gang multiple processors together. In this instance, we can have up to 28 of these G4 processors. So if you've ever witnessed the power of an Apple G4, you can guess what happens when you start ganging 28 of these together. Being able to do 90 gigaflops every second is a fantastic amount of processing capability. In addition to that, adding storage into these capabilities by having hard disk drives in this fashion here also provides for local storage of these compressed contents. In order to do that, we actually do these in the compressed domain as software elements. So this block diagram that you see here is the ganging of multiple functions that are all done in software. Each of these boxes represents a software component, and we can create these various components, determine how we're going to hook these each together, and allow for the overall functionality that's required in a particular station. So we have multiple streams that can come in from the network feed, from a local feed, in the compressed domain, pick out any of the services that are of interest in there so we can deal with HD or multiple SD standards, have a file server so that you can store them locally, be able to call them back out, seamlessly splice any of those elements together, and create a multi-transport stream and deal with the statistical multiplexing, the PSIP manipulation that George mentioned, the data casting information that George also mentioned, and be able to do all of those elements in a single box, all with a software platform that can be upgraded, can be scaled, can be further improved over time. So that by doing everything in the software domain, we're not locked into particular performance issues as we move forward. And coming out, being able to then deliver compressed domain transport streams that are now personalized to the output that you particularly want to have there. And Jerry will speak a little bit more if I leave him any time. The way we do this is that we have a piece of software. In fact, let me just go back to that. This configuration manager down here is a piece of software that actually defines the personality of this overall box. On startup, it determines, and in real time, in runtime, also determines, you told me that was going to happen, so, man, I got to figure out how to do that. We had a bet on exactly how far into the presentation that would come up. I think Jerry won. The configuration manager is a piece of software that determines what functionality is required, what processor each of these different functions can run upon, where their inputs are coming from, where their outputs are going to, and over time can redirect the overall personality of this box so that it can determine that it's going to be just a single HD stream that's going across here, or it can create multiple splicers if we're going to be running in multiple standard definition streams, and then switch back and be very agile about the way we create functionality that's going into here. See, that's that agile vision that we have. Nope, I'm going backwards. So we have that so that we can now create any of the components in the data pipes, map those components to the particular processors at hand, and also provide a single interface to external control automation. So the other piece of functionality that configuration manager applies is talking to control automation vendors, pulling their commands in, interpreting those, and passing those comments on to the those commands onto the particular functions software components to be created. It also can take status messages from the components and deliver them back out so that you can have interactivity. This actually creates a whole new paradigm for how control automation is done, because rather than having multiple boxes that all need to be bolted together and worrying about their interoperability and how those things get adjusted by various automation vendors, all that is taken care of in a single box, and we deal with the translations that happen there. In order to facilitate our transition scenario, we've leveraged an awful lot of the activities already going on there so that we are very friendly to these various station automation systems, so that we use protocols that are very standard in the industry for file server, splicing, and logo insertion. So let's talk about compressed domain splicing. As I mentioned, early attempts at this, we were able to create some good seamless splices that were happening, but in other cases, they weren't always seamless. There would always have to be some of the opportunities and first efforts at this created splices that required a black frame between them, or would give you the option of freezing the frame for several frames before you actually affected the splice. The feedback we got back from that is that's not the way television works today. That's not the way it should work in the digital domain either. And so being able to seamlessly do that type of switch and insert that program element is clearly a very, very important process. So as you look at this from a compressed domain, you have to deal with a couple of things. First, you have to make sure that your syntax and the MPEG is compliant, because if you mess up a bit anywhere in that transmitted signal, the decoder doesn't know where it's goes off in a different direction from where it's supposed to be going. And the result that you get on the screen, you've probably seen an awful lot, can be anywhere from a freeze to a blank screen to green blocks all over the place. It gets ugly. Okay, so you need to make sure that your MPEG syntax is absolutely correct. The other piece is just as bad, which is the buffer compliance. And if you don't manage the buffers properly, then what that's going to lead to is bits getting bad in the stream and everything going off in a different direction, and same types of things happen again. So inherent in our system, we pay a lot of attention to the VBV buffer. It is, in effect, what the encoders do. They keep a model of the buffer that the decoder is doing, and it determines what's the amount of bits that are in a particular frame. So in this instance, you see multiple frames happening here. So this was the first frame that happened. A smaller amount of bits was used in the next frame, small amount of bits in the third. Fourth one was a bit bigger as it builds up. And as part of that, you needed to make sure that you managed the startup. You have to build up this number of bits and keep that at a level as the decoder starts to see a new program. Otherwise, bad things are going to happen, and we'll talk about that. So this element of having a correct startup delay is very, very critical. So as you go through this, you start up with a correct startup delay. And if everything happens properly, then you go through this trajectory and you stay below between where it's empty and where it's full. Somehow I'm going to have to stop this thing from advancing. But if you don't do that correctly, you can have a couple of bad things. If you start up too short, if you don't give it enough bits to build up where this correct level is, as the decoder starts pulling out the bits for each frame, as it decodes it, over time, it's suddenly going to go to a point where it goes to find the bits and they haven't been transmitted yet. You started things up too early, didn't store enough bits, and now it goes to make a picture and it can't because nothing's there. And whenever you have that, all of a sudden you're going to have the decoder going off in an improper direction. The opposite is just as bad. If you let it go for too long before it happens, then all of a sudden you've sent things and it goes to get them and it can't send the bits fast enough. And now you've got an issue where it never sees these bits because the buffer is overflowed. And again, you have bad pictures. So in each of the technologies that we employ here, we go and provide that compressed domain splicing with no degradation of the picture quality. We identify appropriate points to splice. We respond immediately to the splice points and do that so that we will splice out of the stream we're in at any anchor frame on either an I or a P. So the delay that we may have from a command to splice is typically 1 to 2 frames, depending upon whether there is a B frame that we're actually processing on right now. We will splice in on an I frame and be able to deal with the buffering of those streams that you're going to be splicing into to ensure that that is ready to splice into at that next particular time. It's one of the advantages, again, of having a software-based system so that you can deal with a lot of memory buffering within the box. And finally, we do monitoring of that BBV buffer compliance to make sure that that's always there. Audio splicing is very much similar. It operates on frame boundaries. But we rely on the video splicer to determine when the time is that it's going to splice. And they have to be acting in accordance with one another, because if the audio splicer splices away and the video splicer needed to work a little bit more to get to that next anchor frame, then you can get out of lip sync. And that's one of the issues that you usually need to look at as you look at some of these splicing systems that are out there. As I mentioned about the commands that come across, we do, this is an easier one to talk through here. The architecture that we use is that we can have this be either standard definition or high definition. We take it out of the transport streams and find the video packetized elementary streams and the audio packetized elementary streams. We look at the various opportunities for splice points that are happening here. When we get a command that tells us that we need to splice now from that message handler, we tell the video splicer to splice. We then tell the audio splicer, now you can splice as well, and we monitor the models here to make sure that the compliance of these are ensured at all times so that you have truly seamless. Logo insertion. As George mentioned, it's a big issue that's out there, and people need to be able to have that capability. We heard that, and we built that in. And in order to do that, you actually have to do some significant manipulations on the actual compressed picture. And that's why some of the systems out there can't do this. But when you have a software-based platform with many, many gigaflops, you can do that by going through a full decode, but hanging on to all the bitstream information that originally placed this together. By doing logo and rate control as a software function, we could manipulate down to the pixels, but still keep all the coded information where you haven't touched the picture. And then finally do a smart re-encoding of the process so that you carry forward as much of the previous coded information, preserving that original picture quality as you possibly can. Many of the other opportunities, the mole technology that came out of the Atlantic project is somewhat similar, but because that goes from box to box, it can't carry all the coding information parameters with it. By collapsing all these functions into a single box, we can have access to any of the information that was previously in there. And because of this, we were able to allow both bug insertion, message crawl, and you can do rate control so that you can reduce the number of bits and do some trade-offs between picture quality and bits so that you can add in either data services because you want to enhance the service, or perhaps squeeze down the HD service so that you can add in an additional standard definition program as well. Briefly to talk about this, as we get down into various macro blocks, if this is the area that we're going to put the logo in, we identify those particular blocks that we're going to be manipulated. We tag them so that we know that we have to recode those with new information. We also have to go find any of the blocks that pointed into that as a reference because of motion estimation, tag those blocks similarly, but all the other ones we can still maintain and be able to deal with those in their originally coded information. Because we have it in this domain now, we can also now play some additional tricks on this so that we can modify that coding information but prior to going off to that smart recoder so that we can quantize it more to fit in more space. We can reduce the number of coefficients that are being utilized. And because of this, we now enable an awful lot of capabilities. The data services, the logo insertion, being able to deal with the insertion of PSIP capabilities and manage those so that you don't have to worry about the fact that the network feed is sending it everything on channel 80, being able to get that correct. And because this is a scalable system, we can build in a roadmap with additional capabilities so that we can enhance the PSIP capabilities and do a number of other functions. And I think what I'm going to do is zoom ahead of that so that I give Jerry a chance to talk about some of the new capabilities that we're going to be able to do in the application space. So really, this is all about trying to enable flexibility to the broadcasters. And Jerry, do you want to come up and talk about some of those applications that we're now going to be able to address?
Thanks, Terry. Good afternoon. I'm going to go back just very quickly to one particular slide that Terry used as a reference. Here, the AGB 1000 product that we are commercializing, this technology, applying to applications, provides for the flexibility as a result of it being a software-based architecture and a system that is migratable and expandable. We've just included a new feature that Terry didn't mention, which was the input encoding. So now, in addition to receiving MPEG streams from external transport streams, manipulating in the MPEG compressed domain and outputting those manipulated, reformatted MPEG streams, we in addition take in the standard definition content. The uncompressed content. So, bringing us to applications. The first application for the DTV implementation provides us an ability to manipulate compressed ATSC DTV transport streams. Seamless splicing, as Terry explained, high quality logo insertion. In fact, we can insert up to 4 logos on each program within each transport stream, whether that program be high definition, for high definition logo insert, or standard definition, or multiple program standard definition. Again, each program containing 4 logos. Content is either HD or SD, incorporating data casting. We have a PSIP generator internal to the box, as well as interfacing with all of the external PSIP generators. And we've got our own steering wheel to provide all of the functionality and extract the feature set and, as Terry mentioned, as well interface and integrate with all of the third-party automation, as well as a gigabit Ethernet interface to integrate with external file servers for file transfer for nearline hierarchical storage. So the first application is digital television, and the implementation of these software components through the configuration manager in a virtual sense allows us to proceed to a new application. And we talked about the ability to achieve and maintain that highest image quality, to differentiate your DTV content from your NTSC content, and to reduce the cost of implementation. But central casting here provides us an opportunity to distribute that content either in the DTV space or the current NTSC space. Broadcasting organizations, whether they're PBS or commercial broadcasters, are concentrating their content at centralized facility and distributing that content to their member stations. These systems are identifying groups that can receive common content that is shared and distributed amongst all. They may be structured in a geographical region or across multiple geographic regions, and within each group, a hub is established. This hub originates the programming for not only itself, but also its satellite member stations. We've taken the AGV 1000 core technology, and we've repackaged the technology to implement new applications and functionality. On the right-hand side of the screen is the central caster, and that's for the hub. On the left-hand side, my right here, is the satellite central caster. So the architecture looks like this. We've got the consolidated content at the hub, distributing its content over leased lines, fiber, ATM interfaces, satellite, to multiple stations in multiple cities. The transport streams are, like the DTV AGV 1000 implementation, they've got content, they've got logos, they've got commercials or interstitial material. They're receiving a multiple program, multiple perhaps network feeds, and distributing the content that's appropriate to each of the satellite sites. So the example here on the two arrows up on top, network number one, let's say, for example, Warner Brothers or Fox, has a standard definition MPEG transport stream. Network two, same thing, file server content at the hub, providing the interstitial content, same software components, the DMUX, the preselect, the rate control, the splicer, the logo insert if required at the hub, sends up to 12 transport streams from 6 to 12 megabits per second. Remember, we're not specifically required to distribute ATSC 1939, although we do, but you may reduce your bandwidth depending upon your determined quality of service and distribute that data rate over a transport stream and multiple transport streams to the satellite facility. So the incoming feed from the network. Incoming feed from the network, DMUXed, receives from the local content, encoded locally, spliced together, local control, local data, emergency alert system information, logo inserted at the local station for local content identification, remuxed, and here we see transport stream out to the DTV transmitter, and here we see decoded 7259 out to the NTSC transmitter. We are demonstrating this technology implementation and seeking your feedback for feature set implementations at our booth. But that's our ad. And the concept here is integrating through a software perspective, an integrated software solution in just one box. Thank you. Questions?
We typically take in IP packets that are encapsulated into transport streams and then identify the services that need to be multiplexed in. Oh, okay. The question was, how do we handle data services and the packetized streams that may come in as data services to enable data casting? And as we do with PSIP, we have the capability to have local storage of those data services so that we can implement carousels from the local hub, the local storage, or we can interface to other services like the TriVeni system to be able to take in a transport stream, be able to, and then in the control software, be able to identify what type of services, how you want to mix those types of things in.
That handles a local insertion. How do you handle pass-through from national?
Oh, okay. In the preselector, if one of those services that wants to be passed through, then in the control setup, you identify those packetized services that want to be passed through. So if data services from the network want to be passed through, we pass those through into the multiplex. If they want to be left and reuse that information or reuse that space to be able to do local data services, then we do that as well.
One concern, it looks like, I'm sorry, if you're going to finish.
Lou explains that we are short of time, so let's permit two additional questions. Is that all right?
Fine.
A couple questions, please.
Concerned with having everything in one box, it looks like a big single point of failure. What kind of redundancy do you have in the system?
It's a good question. In terms of redundancy and fault tolerance, both from a hardware architectural perspective as well as a software architectural perspective, so let's describe each independently. From a hardware perspective, we've got all the traditional, typical file server broadcast master control room requirements, such as RAID architecture, hot swappable power supplies, modular accessible hot swappable fans, front and rear access, redundant processors on each board, multiple boards of the same configuration. But hardware is only partially the story. From a software architectural perspective, all the functionality resides within one box, whether it be logo insert or splicing or rate control or remultiplexing. Those processors may be handled because we've got multiple G4s, up to 28, a raceway architecture that looks upon all 28 as one, and no one process, no software function resides on any specific processor at any time. It transcends across throughout all on a massively parallel processing system. When a fault is recognized by the architecture of the software, the assignment of the function is reassigned to another processor. So worst case scenario, let's say you're doing a high definition stream and a standard definition stream, and you're splicing local content from the file server and from the network and inserting four logos on each of those programs and performing emergency alert system all simultaneously, and you suffer a failure. Worst case is you degrade your performance that maybe you have three logos on screen at the same time. So not a significant on-air operational performance. It's built with the requirements for the foreknowledge that this is going into the cash register of the station. And so from a hardware perspective, we've been doing this many years. The expectations of fault tolerance are there. From a software perspective is really the key where we need to be smart, and to which we are looking at providing automatic, without human intervention, performance degradation of the less critical functionality of the box. Excuse my cold, but I think I'm answering the question. One more?
I understand that you have a StatMux, and it's is that StatMux throttling all of the elementary streams within the box, that capability there?
Good question.
It has the capability to do that rate control. Any time you create a function on a particular transport stream and attach rate control to that, it will allow you to be able to perform that rate control amongst those streams. If you determine that there's ones that you do not want to have that throttling done on, then that can be programmed to just pass that through as it had been.
Okay, and can you throttle the local sources as well?
Yes.
We're out of time. Thank you.